now looked at me and said, "What are you looking at the geese for?" I looked at him. He was a stupid, moon-faced fellow of 20. I'm always on the side of the peasantry, you know. I like talking to the peasants. We've dropped behind the peasants. That's an axiom. I believe you're laughing, Karamazov. No, heaven forbid, I'm listening, said Alyosha with the most good-natured air, and the sensitive collier was immediately reassured. My theory, Karamazov, is clear and simple, he hurried on again, looking pleased. I believe in the people, and am always glad to give them their due, but I'm not for spoiling them. That is a sine qua non. But I was telling you about the goose, so I turned to the fool and answered, I'm wondering what the goose thinks about. He looked at me quite stupidly. And what does the goose think about, he asked. Do you see that cart full of oats, I said. The oats are dropping out of the sack, and the goose has put its neck right under the wheel to gobble them up. Do you see? I see that quite well, he said. Well, said I, if that cart were to move on a little, would it break the goose's neck or not? It'd be sure to break it, and he grinned all over his face, highly delighted. Come on, then, said I, let's try. Let's, he said, and it did not take us long to arrange. He stood at the bridle, without being noticed, and I stood on one side to direct the goose. And the owner wasn't looking, he was talking to someone, so I had nothing to do. The goose thrust its head in after the oats of itself, under the cart, just under the wheel. I winked at the lad, he tugged at the bridle, and crack. The goose's neck was broken in half. And, as luck would have it, all the peasants saw us at that moment, and they kicked up a shindy at once. You did that on purpose. No, not on purpose. Yes, you did, on purpose. Well, they shouted, take him to the justice of the peace. They took me too. You were there too, they said. You helped. You're known all over the market. And for some reason I really am known all over the market, Collier added conceitedly. We all went off to the justice's. They brought the goose too. The fellow was crying in a great funk, simply blubbering like a woman. And the farmer kept shouting that you could kill any number of geese like that. Well, of course, there were witnesses. The justice of the peace settled it in a minute, that the farmer was to be paid a ruble for the goose, and the fella to have the goose. And he was warned not to play such pranks again. And the fella kept blubbering like a woman. It wasn't me, he said. It was he egged me on. And he pointed to me. I answered with the utmost composure that I hadn't egged him on, that I simply stated the general proposition, had spoken hypothetically. The justice of the peace smiled, and was vexed with himself at once for having smiled. I'll complain to your masters of you, so that for the future you mayn't waste your time on such general propositions, instead of sitting at your books and learning your lessons. There's another question, and such a question. You see, I so love humanity that, would you believe it, I often dream of forsaking all that I have, leaving Lisa and becoming a Sister of Mercy. I close my eyes and think and dream, and at that moment I feel full of strength to overcome all obstacles. No wounds, no festering sores could at that moment frighten me. I would bind them up and wash them with my own hands. I would nurse the afflicted. I would be ready to kiss such wounds.
It is much, and well that your mind is full of such dreams and not others. Sometime, unawares, you may do a good deed in reality.
Yes, but could I endure such a life for long?
The lady went on fervently, almost frantically.
That's the chief question. That's my most agonizing question. I shut my eyes and asked myself, would you persevere long on that path? And if the patient whose wounds you are washing did not meet you with gratitude, but worried you with his whims, without valuing or remarking your charitable services, began abusing you and rudely commanding you, and complaining to the superior authorities of you, which often happens when people are in great suffering, what then? Would you persevere in your love or not? And you know, I came with horror to the conclusion that if anything could dissipate my love to humanity, it would be ingratitude. In short, I am a hired servant. I expect my payment at once. That is praise, and the repayment of love with love. Otherwise, I'm incapable of loving anyone.
She was in a very paroxysm of self-castigation, and concluding, she looked with defiant resolution at the elder. It's just the same story as a doctor once told me, observed the elder. He was a man, getting on in years and undoubtedly clever. He spoke as frankly as you, though in jest, in bitter jest. "I love humanity," he said, "but I wonder at myself. The more I love humanity in general, the less I love man in particular. In my dreams," he said, "I've often come to making enthusiastic schemes for the service of humanity, and perhaps I might actually have faced crucifixion if it had been suddenly necessary. And yet I am incapable of living in the same room with anyone for 2 days together, as I know by experience. As soon as anyone is near me, his personality disturbs my self-complacency and restricts my freedom. In 24 hours, I begin to hate the best of men. One, because he's too long over his dinner. Another, because he has a cold and keeps on blowing his nose. I become hostile to people the moment they come close to me. But it has always happened that the more I detest men individually, the more ardent becomes my love for humanity."
"But what's to be done? What can one do in such a case? Must one despair?"
"No, it is enough that you are distressed at it. Do what you can, and it will be reckoned unto you. Much is done already in you since you can so deeply and sincerely know yourself. If you have been talking to me so sincerely, simply to gain approbation for your frankness, as you did from me just now, then of course you will not attain to anything in the achievement of real love. It will all get no further than dreams, and your whole life will slip away like a phantom. In that case, you will naturally cease to think of the future life, too, and will, of yourself, grow calmer, after a fashion, in the end."
"You have crushed me. Only now, as you speak, I understand that I was really only seeking your approbation for my sincerity, when I told you I could not endure ingratitude. You have revealed me to myself. You have seen through me and explained me to myself."
"Are you speaking the truth? Well, now, after such a confession, I believe that you are sincere and good at heart. If you do not attain happiness, always remember that you are on the right road, and try not to leave it. Above all, avoid falsehood, every kind of falsehood, especially falseness to yourself. Watch over your own deceitfulness and look into it every hour, every minute. Avoid being scornful, both to others and to yourself. What seems to you bad within you will grow purer from the very fact of your observing it in yourself. Avoid fear, too, though fear is only the consequence of every sort of falsehood. Never be frightened at your own faint-heartedness in attaining love. Don't be frightened overmuch even at your evil actions. I'm sorry I can say nothing more consoling to you, for love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared with love in dreams. Love in dreams is greedy for immediate action, rapidly performed and in the sight of all. Men will even give their lives if only the ordeal does not last long but is soon over, with all looking on and applauding as though on the stage. But active love is labor and fortitude, and for some people too, perhaps, a complete science. But I predict that just when you see with horror that in spite of all your efforts you are getting further from your goal instead of nearer to it, at that very moment I predict that you will reach it and behold clearly the miraculous power of the Lord who has been all the time loving and mysteriously guiding you. Forgive me for not being able to stay longer with you. They're waiting for me. Goodbye.
The lady was weeping. "Lisa, Lisa, bless her, bless her," she cried, starting up suddenly.
"She does not deserve to be loved. I've seen her naughtiness all along," the elder said jestingly. "Why have you been laughing at Alexei?"
Lisa had, in fact, been occupied in mocking at him all the time. She had noticed before that Alyosha was shy and tried not to look at her, and she found this extremely amusing. She waited intently to catch his eye. Alyosha, unable to endure her persistent stare, was irresistibly and suddenly drawn to glance at her, and at once she smiled triumphantly in his face. Alyosha was even more disconcerted and vexed. At last he turned away from her altogether and hid behind the elder's back.
After a few minutes, drawn by the same irresistible force, he turned again to see whether he was being looked at or not, and found Lisa almost hanging out of her chair to peep sideways at him, eagerly waiting for him to look. Catching his eye, she laughed, so that the elder could not help saying, "Why do you make fun of him like that, naughty girl?" Lisa suddenly and quite unexpectedly blushed. Her eyes flashed and her face became quite serious. She began speaking quickly and nervously in a warm and resentful voice.
"Why has he forgotten everything, then? He used to carry me about when I was little. We used to play together. He used to come to teach me to read, do you know? 2 years ago, when he went away, he said that he would never forget me, that we were friends forever, forever, forever. And now he's afraid of me all at once. Am I going to eat him? Why doesn't he want to come near me? Why doesn't he talk? Why won't he come and see us? It's not that you won't let him. We know that he goes everywhere. It's not good manners for me to invite him. He ought to have thought of it first, if he hasn't forgotten me. No, now he's saving his soul. Why have you put that long gown on him? If he runs, he'll fall."
And suddenly she hid her face in her hand and went off into irresistible, prolonged, nervous, inaudible laughter. The elder listened to her with a smile and blessed her tenderly. As she kissed his hand, she suddenly pressed it to her eyes and began crying.
"Don't be angry with me. I'm silly and good for nothing. And perhaps Alyosha's right, quite right, in not wanting to come and see such a ridiculous girl."
"I will certainly send him," said the elder.
He didn't complain to the masters, that was a joke, but the matter was noised abroad and came to the ears of the masters. Their ears are long, you know. The classical master, called Kolbasnikov, was particularly shocked about it, but Dardanelov got me off again. But Kolbasnikov is savage with everyone now, like a green ass. Did you know, Ilusha, he's just married, got a dowry of 1,000 rubles, and his bride's a regular fright of the first rank and the last degree. The third-class fellows wrote an epigram on it. Astounding news has reached the class. Kolbasnikov has been an ass. And so on. Awfully funny. I'll bring it to you later on. I say nothing against Dardanelov. He's a learned man. There's no doubt about it. I respect men like that, and it's not because he stood up for me.
But you took him down about the founders of Troy,
Smurov put in suddenly, unmistakably proud of Krasotkin at such a moment. He was particularly pleased with the story of the goose.
"Did you really take him down?"
the captain inquired, in a flattering way. "On the question who founded Troy? We heard of it. Ilusha told me about it at the time."
"He knows everything, father. He knows more than any of us," put in Ilusha. "He only pretends to be like that, but really, he's top in every subject."
Ilusha looked at Kolya with infinite happiness. "Oh, that's all nonsense about Troy, a trivial matter. I consider this an unimportant question," said Kolya with haughty humility. He had by now completely recovered his dignity, though he was still a little uneasy. He felt that he was greatly excited, and that he talked about the goose, for instance, with too little reserve, while Alyosha had looked serious and had not said a word all the time. And the vain boy began by degrees to have a rankling fear that Alyosha was silent because he despised him, and thought he was showing off before him. If he dared to think anything like that, Kolya would.
"I regard the question as quite a trivial one,"
he rapped out again proudly. "And I know who founded Troy," a boy who had not spoken before said suddenly, to the surprise of everyone. He was silent and seemed to be shy. He was a pretty boy of about 11, called Kartashov. He was sitting near the door. Kolya looked at him with dignified amazement. The fact was that the identity of the founders of Troy had become a secret for the whole school, a secret which could only be discovered by reading Smaragdov, and no one had Smaragdov but Kolya. One day, when Kolya's back was turned, Kartashov hastily opened Smaragdov, which lay among Kolya's books, and immediately lighted on the passage relating to the foundation of Troy. This was a good time ago, but he felt uneasy and could not bring himself to announce publicly that he, too, knew who had founded Troy, afraid of what might happen, and of Krasotkin somehow putting him to shame over it.
But now he couldn't resist saying it. For weeks he'd been longing to.
"Well, who did found it?"
asked Colliard, turning to him with haughty superciliousness. He saw from his face that he really did know, and at once made up his mind how to take it. There was, so to speak, a discordant note in the general harmony.
"Troy was founded by Teucer, Dardanus, Ilius, and Tros."
The boy rapped out at once, and in the same instant he blushed so that it was painful to look at him. But the boy stared at him for a whole minute, and then all the staring eyes turned at once and were fastened upon Kolya, who was still scanning the audacious boy with disdainful composure.
"In what sense did they found it?"
he deigned to comment at last. "And what is meant by founding a city or a state? What did they do? Did they go each and lay a brick, do you suppose?" There was laughter. The offending boy turned from pink to crimson. He was silent, and on the point of tears. Kolya held him so for a minute.
"Before you talk of a historical event like the foundation of a nationality, you must first understand what you mean by it,"
he admonished him in stern, incisive tones.
"But I attach no consequence to these old wise tales, and I don't think much of universal history in general,"
he added carelessly, addressing the company generally.
"Universal history?"
the captain inquired, looking almost scared.
"Yes, universal history. It's a study of the successive follies of mankind, and nothing more. The only subjects I respect are mathematics and natural science,"
said Kolya. He was showing off, and he stole a glance at Alyosha. His was the only opinion he was afraid of there. But Alyosha was still silent, and still serious as before. If Alyosha had said a word, it would have stopped him. But Alyosha was silent, and it might be the silence of contempt, and that finally irritated Kolya.
"The classical languages, too, they're simply madness, nothing more. You seem to disagree with me again, Karamazov."
"I don't agree," said Alyosha with a faint smile.
"The study of the classics, if you ask my opinion, is simply a police measure. That's simply why it has been introduced into our schools."
By degrees, Kolya began to get breathless again.
Latin and Greek were introduced because they're a bore and because they stupefy the intellect. It was dull before, so what could they do to make things duller? It was senseless enough before, so what could they do to make it more senseless? So they thought of Greek and Latin. That's my opinion. I hope I shall never change it."
Kolya finished abruptly. His cheeks were flushed.
"That's true,"
assented Smurov suddenly in a ringing tone of conviction. He had listened attentively.
"And yet he's first in Latin himself," cried one of the group of boys suddenly. "Yes, father, he says that, and yet he's first in Latin,"
echoed Ilusha.
"What of it?"
Kolya thought fit to defend himself, though the praise was very sweet to him.
"I'm fagging away at Latin because I have to, because I promised my mother to pass my examination, and I think that whatever you do, it's worth doing it well. But in my soul I have a profound contempt for the classics and all that fraud." "You don't agree, Karamazov?"
"Why fraud?" Alyosha smiled again.
"Well, all the classical authors have been translated into all languages, so it was not for the sake of studying the classics they introduced Latin, but solely as a police measure to stupefy the intelligence. So what can one call it but a fraud?"
"Why, who taught you all this?" cried Alyosha, surprised at last.
"In the first place, I am capable of thinking for myself without being taught. Besides, what I said just now about the classics being translated, our teacher, Kolbasnikov, had said to the whole of the third class." "The doctor has come," cried Nina, who had been silent till then.
A carriage belonging to Madame Holakov drove up to the gate. The captain, who had been expecting the doctor all the morning, rushed headlong out to meet him. Mama pulled herself together and assumed a dignified air. Alyosha went up to Ilusha and began setting his pillow straight. Nina, from her invalid chair, anxiously watched him putting the bed tidy. The boys hurriedly took leave. Some of them promised to come again in the evening. Kolya called Perezvon, and the dog jumped off the bed.
"I won't go away. I won't go away,"
Kolya said hastily to Ilusha.
"I'll wait in the passage and come back when the doctor's gone. I'll come back with Perezvon."
But by now the doctor had entered, an important-looking person with long, dark whiskers and a shiny, shaven chin, wearing a bearskin coat. As he crossed the threshold, he stopped, taken aback. He probably fancied he'd come to the wrong place. "How is this? Where am I?" he muttered, not removing his coat nor his peaked sealskin cap. The crowd, the poverty of the room, the washing hanging on a line in the corner puzzled him. The captain, bent double, was bowing low before him. "It's here, sir. Here, sir," he muttered cringingly. "It's here. You've come right. You were coming to us. Sneggirioff," the doctor said loudly and pompously. "Mr. Sneggirioff, is that you?" "That's me, sir." "Ah." The doctor looked round the room with a squeamish air once more and threw off his coat, displaying to all eyes the grand decoration at his neck. The captain caught the fur coat in the air, and the doctor took off his cap. "Where is the patient?" he asked emphatically. Chapter 6. Precocity. "What do you think the doctor will say to him?" Collier asked quickly. "What a repulsive mug, though, hasn't he? I can't endure medicine." "Ilusha is dying. I think that's certain," answered Alyosha mournfully. "They're rogues. Medicine's a fraud. I'm glad to have made your acquaintance, though, Karamazov. I wanted to know you for a long time. I'm only sorry we meet in such sad circumstances." Collier had a great inclination to say something even warmer and more demonstrative, but he felt ill at ease. Alyosha noticed this, smiled, and pressed his hand. "I've long learned to respect you as a rare person," Collier muttered again, faltering and uncertain. "I've heard you're a mystic and have been in the monastery. I know you're a mystic, but that hasn't put me off. Contact with real life will cure you. It's always so with characters like yours." "What do you mean by mystic? Cure me of what?" Alyosha was rather astonished. "Oh, God, and all the rest of it." "What, don't you believe in God?" "Oh, I've nothing against God. Of course, God is only a hypothesis, but I admit that he is needed for the order of the universe and all that, and that if there were no God, he would have to be invented," added Collier, beginning to blush. He suddenly fancied that Alyosha might think he was trying to show off his knowledge and to prove that he was grown up. "I haven't the slightest desire to show off my knowledge to him," Collier thought indignantly, and all of a sudden he felt horribly annoyed. "I must confess I can't endure entering on such discussions," he said with a final air. "It's possible for one who doesn't believe in God to love mankind, don't you think so? Voltaire didn't believe in God and loved mankind." "I'm at it again," he thought to himself. "Voltaire believed in God, though not very much, I think, and I don't think he loved mankind very much either," said Alyosha quietly, gently, and quite naturally, as though he were talking to someone of his own age or even older. Collier was particularly struck by Alyosha's apparent diffidence about his opinion of Voltaire. He seemed to be leaving the question for him, little Collier, to settle. "Have you read Voltaire?" Alyosha finished. "No, not to say read, but I've read Candide in the Russian translation, in an absurd, grotesque old translation." "At it again, again. And did you understand it?" "Oh, yes, everything. That is, why do you suppose I shouldn't understand? There's a lot of nastiness in it, of course. Of course, I can understand that it's a philosophical novel and written to advocate an idea." Collier was getting mixed by now. "I'm a socialist, Karamazov. I'm an incurable socialist," he announced suddenly, apropos of nothing. "A socialist?" laughed Alyosha. "But when have you had time to become one? Why, I thought you were only 13. Collier winced. "In the first place, I'm not 13, but 14. Well, 14 in a fortnight," he flushed angrily. "And in the second place, I'm at a complete loss to understand what my age has to do with it. The question is, what are my convictions, not what is my age, isn't it?" "When you're older, you'll understand for yourself the influence of age on convictions. I fancied, too, that you were not expressing your own ideas," Alyosha answered serenely and modestly. But Kolya interrupted him hotly. "Come, you want obedience and mysticism. You must admit that the Christian religion, for instance, has only been of use to the rich and the powerful to keep the lower classes in slavery. That's so, isn't it?" "Ah, I know where you read that. and I'm sure someone told you so," cried Alyosha. "I say, what makes you think I read it? And certainly no one told me so. I can think for myself. I'm not opposed to Christ, if you like. He was a most humane person, and if he were alive today he would be found in the ranks of the revolutionists, and would perhaps play a conspicuous part. There's no doubt about that."
"Oh, where did you get that from? What fool have you made friends with?" exclaimed Alyosha.
"Calm, the truth will out. It has so chanced that I've often talked to Mr. Rakitin, of course, but old Bielensky said that too, so they say."
"Bielensky, I don't remember. He hasn't written that anywhere?"
"Well, if he didn't write it, they say he said it. I heard that from a—but never mind."
"And have you read Bielensky?"
"Well, no, I haven't read all of him, but I read the passage about Tatiana, why she didn't go off with Onyegin."
"Didn't go off with Onyegin? Surely you don't understand that already?"
"Why, you seem to take me for little Smurov," said Kolya with a grin of irritation. "But please don't suppose I'm such a revolutionist. I often disagree with Mr. Rakitin. Though I mention Tatiana, I'm not at all for the emancipation of women. I acknowledge that women are a subject race and must obey. Les femmes tricotons, as Napoleon said."
Kolya, for some reason, smiled.
"And on that question, at least, I'm quite of one mind with that pseudo-great man. I think, too, that to leave one's country and fly to America is mean. Worse than mean, silly. Why go to America when one may be of great service to humanity here, now especially? There's a perfect mass of fruitful activity open to us." "That's what I answered."
"What do you mean, answered whom? Has someone suggested you're going to America already?"
"I must own they've been at me to go, but I declined. That's between ourselves, of course, Karamazov. Do you hear? Not a word to anyone. I say this only to you. I'm not at all anxious to fall into the clutches of the secret police and take lessons at the Chain Bridge. Long will you remember the house at the Chain Bridge. Do you remember? It's splendid. Why, you're laughing. You don't suppose I'm fibbing, do you? What if he should find out that I've only that one number of The Bell in Father's bookcase, and haven't read any more of it?"
Kolya thought with a shudder.
"Oh, no, I'm not laughing, and don't suppose for a moment that you're lying. No, indeed, I can't suppose so, for all this, alas, is perfectly true. But tell me, have you read Pushkin, Onyegin, for instance? You spoke just now of Tatiana." "No, I haven't read it yet, but I want to read it. I have no prejudices, Karamazov. I want to hear both sides."
"What makes you ask?"
"Oh, nothing." "Tell me, Karamazov, have you an awful contempt for me?"
Kolya rapped out suddenly and drew himself up before Alyosha, as though he were on drill.
"Be so kind as to tell me without beating about the bush."
"I have a contempt for you?"
Alyosha looked at him wonderingly.
"What for? I'm only sad that a charming nature such as yours should be perverted by all this crude nonsense before you've begun life."
"Don't be anxious about my nature," Kolya interrupted, not without complacency. "But it's true that I am stupidly sensitive, crudely sensitive. You smiled just now, and I fancied you seemed to—"
"Oh, my smile meant something quite different. I'll tell you why I smiled. Not long ago I read the criticism made by a German who had lived in Russia on our students and schoolboys of today. Show a Russian schoolboy, he writes, a map of the stars which he knows nothing about, and he will give you back the map next day with corrections on it. No knowledge and unbounded conceit, that's what the German meant to say about the Russian schoolboy."
"Yes, that's perfectly right," Kolya laughed suddenly. "Exactly so, bravo the German. But he did not see the good side. What do you think? Conceit may be, that comes from youth. That will be corrected if need be. But on the other hand, there is an independent spirit almost from childhood, boldness of thought and conviction, and not the spirit of these sausage-makers grovelling before authority. But the German was right all the same. Bravo, the German. But Germans want strangling all the same. Though they're so good at sciences and learning, they must be strangled."
"Strangled? What for?" smiled Alyosha.
"Well, perhaps I'm talking nonsense, I agree. I'm awfully childish sometimes, and when I'm pleased about anything I can't restrain myself, and am ready to talk any stuff. But I say, we're chattering away here about nothing, and that doctor has been a long time in there. But perhaps he's examining the mamma and that poor crippled Nina. I like that Nina, you know.
She whispered to me suddenly as I was coming away, "Why didn't you come before?" And in such a voice, so reproachfully. "I think she's awfully nice and pathetic."
"Yes, yes. Well, you'll be coming often. You will see what she's like. It would do you a great deal of good to know people like that, to learn to value a great deal, which you will find out from knowing these people," Alyosha observed warmly. "That would have more effect on you than anything."
"Oh, how I regret and blame myself for not having come sooner,"
Kolya exclaimed with bitter feeling. "Yes, it's a great pity. You saw for yourself how delighted the poor child was to see you, and how he fretted for you to come.
Don't tell me you make it worse. But it serves me right. What kept me from coming was my conceit, my egoistic vanity, and the beastly willfulness, which I never can get rid of, though I've been struggling with it all my life. I see that now. I am a beast in lots of ways, Karamazov."
"No, you have a charming nature, though it's been distorted, and I quite understand why you've had such an influence on this generous, morbidly sensitive boy," Alyosha answered warmly.
"And you say that to me," cried Kolya. "And would you believe it, I've thought several times since I've been here, that you despised me. If only you knew how I prize your opinion."
"But are you really so sensitive at your age? Would you believe it, just now when you were telling your story, I thought as I watched you, that you must be very sensitive."
"You thought so? What an eye you've got, I say. I bet that was when I was talking about the goose. That was just when I was fancying you had a great contempt for me, for being in such a hurry to show off. And for a moment I quite hated you for it and began talking like a fool. Then I fancied, just now, here, when I said that if there were no God he would have to be invented, that I was in too great a hurry to display my knowledge, especially as I got that phrase out of a book. But I swear I wasn't showing off out of vanity, though I really don't know why, because I was so pleased. Yes, I believe it was because I was so pleased. Though it's perfectly disgraceful for anyone to be gushing directly they're pleased. I know that. But I am convinced now that you don't despise me. It was all my imagination. Oh, Karamazov, I'm profoundly unhappy. I sometimes fancy all sorts of things, that everyone is laughing at me, the whole world, and then I feel ready to overturn the whole order of things."
"And you worry everyone about you," smiled Alyosha.
"Yes, I worry everyone about me, especially my mother. Karamazov, tell me, am I very ridiculous now?"
"Don't think about that. Don't think of it at all," cried Alyosha. "And what does ridiculous mean? Isn't everyone constantly being or seeming ridiculous? Besides, nearly all clever people now are fearfully afraid of being ridiculous, and that makes them unhappy. All I am surprised at is that you should be feeling that so early, though I've observed it for some time past, and not only in you. Nowadays the very children have begun to suffer from it. It's almost a sort of insanity. The devil has taken the form of that vanity and entered into the whole generation. It's simply the devil," added Alyosha without a trace of the smile that Kolya, staring at him, expected to see. "You're like everyone else," said Alyosha in conclusion. "That is, like very many others. And you must not be like everybody else, that's all."
"Even if everyone is like that?"
"Yes, even if everyone is like that. You be the only one not like it. You really are not like everyone else. Here you are not ashamed to confess to something bad and even ridiculous. And who will admit so much in these days? No one. And people have even ceased to feel the impulse to self-criticism. Don't be like everyone else, even if you were the only one."
"Splendid. I was not mistaken in you. You know how to console one. Oh, how I long to know you, Karamazov. I've long been eager for this meeting. Can you really have thought about me, too? You said just now that you thought of me, too?"
"Yes, I'd heard of you and had thought of you, too. And if it's partly vanity that makes you ask, it doesn't matter."
"Do you know, Karamazov, our talk has been like a declaration of love," said Kolya in a bashful and melting voice. "That's not ridiculous, is it?"
"Not at all ridiculous, and if it were, it wouldn't matter, because it's been a good thing."
Alyosha smiled brightly. "But do you know, Karamazov, you must admit that you are a little ashamed yourself now. I see it by your eyes."
Kolya smiled with a sort of sly happiness. "Why ashamed?"
"Well, why are you blushing?"
"It was you made me blush,"
laughed Alyosha, and he really did blush.
"Oh, well, I am a little, goodness knows why. I don't know. He muttered, almost embarrassed.
Oh, how I love you and admire you at this moment, just because you are rather ashamed, because you're just like me, cried Kolya in positive ecstasy. His cheeks glowed, his eyes beamed. No, Kolya, you will be very unhappy in your life. Something made Alyosha say suddenly, I know, I know. How you know it all beforehand, Kolya agreed at once. But you will bless life on the whole, all the same. Just so. Hurrah! You're a prophet. Oh, we shall get on together, Karamazov. Do you know what delights me most is that you treat me quite like an equal. But we're not equals, no, we're not. You're better. But we shall get on. Do you know, all this last month I've been saying to myself, either we shall be friends at once forever, or we shall part enemies to the grave.
And saying that, of course, you loved me. Alyosha laughed gaily.
I did. I loved you awfully. I've been loving and dreaming of you. And how do you know it all beforehand? Ah, here's the doctor. Goodness, what will he tell us? Look at his face.
Chapter 7. Ilusha. The doctor came out of the room again, muffled in his fur coat and with his cap on his head. His face looked almost angry and disgusted, as though he were afraid of getting dirty. He cast a cursory glance round the passage, looking sternly at Alyosha and Kolya as he did so. Alyosha waved from the door to the coachman, and the carriage that had brought the doctor drove up. The captain darted out after the doctor, and bowing apologetically stopped him to get the last word. The poor fellow looked utterly crushed. There was a scared look in his eyes.
Your Excellency, is it possible?
He began, but could not go on and clasped his hands in despair. Yet he still gazed imploringly at the doctor, as though a word from him might still change the poor boy's fate.
I can't help it, I'm not God,
the doctor answered offhand, though with the customary impressiveness.
Doctor, Your Excellency, and will it be soon, soon?
You must be prepared for anything,
said the doctor in emphatic and incisive tones, and dropping his eyes he was about to step out to the coach.
Your Excellency, for Christ's sake!
The terror-stricken captain stopped him again.
Your Excellency, but can nothing, absolutely nothing, save him now?
It's not in my hands now, said the doctor impatiently, but,
he stopped suddenly.
If you could, for instance, send your patient... At once, without delay.
The words at once, without delay, the doctor uttered with an almost wrathful sternness that made the captain start.
To Syracuse, the change to the new beneficial climatic conditions might possibly affect...
To Syracuse,
cried the captain, unable to grasp what was said.
Syracuse is in Sicily,
Colliard jerked out suddenly in explanation. The doctor looked at him.
"Sicily, Your Excellency,"
faltered the captain.
"But you've seen—"
He spread out his hands, indicating his surroundings.
"Mama and my family—"
"No, no, Sicily is not the place for the family. The family should go to Caucasus in the early spring. Your daughter must go to the Caucasus, and your wife, after a course of the waters in the Caucasus for her rheumatism, must be sent straight to Paris to the mental specialist Le Pelletier. I could give you a note to him, and then there might be a change.
Doctor, doctor, but you see...
The captain flung wide his hands again despairingly, indicating the bare wooden walls of the passage.
Well, that's not my business, grinned the doctor. I've only told you the answer of medical science to your question as to possible treatment. As for the rest, to my regret...
Don't be afraid, apothecary. My dog won't bite you.
Kolya rapped out loudly, noticing the doctor's rather uneasy glance at Perezvon, who was standing in the doorway. There was a wrathful note in Kolya's voice. He used the word apothecary instead of doctor on purpose, and, as he explained afterwards, I used it to insult him.
Well, what's that?
The doctor flung up his head, staring with surprise at Kolya.
Who's this?
He addressed Alyosha as though asking him to explain.
It's Perezvon's master. Don't worry about me.
Kolya said incisively again.
Perezvon?
Repeated the doctor, perplexed. That is, a chime of bells.
He hears the bell, but where it is he cannot tell. Goodbye. We shall meet in Syracuse.
Who's this? Who's this?
The doctor flew into a terrible rage.
He's a schoolboy, doctor. He's a mischievous boy. Take no notice of him, said Alyosha, frowning and speaking quickly.
Kolya, hold your tongue, he cried to Krasotkin. Take no notice of him, doctor, he repeated rather impatiently.
He wants a thrashing, a good thrashing,
the doctor stamped in a perfect fury.
And you know, apothecary, my Paris one might bite, said Kolya, turning pale with quivering voice and flashing eyes. Ici, Paris von.
Kolya, if you say another word, I'll have nothing more to do with you, Alyosha cried peremptorily.
There's only one man in the world who can command Nikolai Krasotkin. This is the man.
Kolya pointed to Alyosha.
I obey him. Goodbye.
He stepped forward, opened the door, and quickly went into the inner room. Perez von flew after him. The doctor stood still for 5 seconds in amazement, looking at Alyosha. Then, with a curse, he went out quickly to the carriage, repeating aloud,
I don't know what it is.
The captain darted forward to help him into the carriage. Alyosha followed Kolya into the room. He was already by Ilusha's bedside. The sick boy was holding his hand and calling for his father. A minute later, the captain, too, came back.
Father, father, come, we...
Ilusha faltered in violent excitement, but apparently unable to go on, he flung his wasted arms round his father and Kolya, uniting them in one embrace, and hugging them as tightly as he could. The captain suddenly began to shake with dumb sobs, and Kolya's lips and chin twitched.
Father, father, how sorry I am for you.
Ilusha moaned bitterly.
Ilusha, darling, the doctor said you would be all right. We shall be happy. The doctor...
The captain began.
Oh, father, I know what the new doctor said to you about me. I saw...
cried Ilusha, and again he hugged them both with all his strength, hiding his face on his father's shoulder.
Father, don't cry, and when I die, get a good boy, another one. Choose one of them all, a good one. Call him Ilusha, and love him instead of me. Hush, old man, you'll get well,
Krasotkin cried suddenly in a voice that sounded angry.
But don't ever forget me, father, Ilusha went on. Come to my grave, and father, bury me by our big stone, where we used to go for our walk, and come to me there with Krasotkin in the evening, and Paris von. I shall expect you, father, father.
His voice broke. They were all three silent, still embracing. Nina was crying quietly in her chair, and at last, seeing them all crying, Mama, too, burst into tears.
Ilusha, Ilusha,
she exclaimed. Krasotkin suddenly released himself from Ilusha's embrace.
Goodbye, old man. Mother expects me back to dinner, he said quickly. What a pity I did not tell her. She'll be dreadfully anxious. But after dinner I'll come back to you for the whole day, for the whole evening, and I'll tell you all sorts of things, all sorts of things, and I'll bring Perez von. But now I'll take him with me because he will begin to howl when I'm away and bother you. Goodbye.
And he ran out into the passage. He didn't want to cry, but in the passage he burst into tears. Alyosha found him crying.
Kolya, you must be sure to keep your word and come, or he will be terribly disappointed.
Alyosha said emphatically,
I will. Oh, how I curse myself for not having come before,
muttered Kolya, crying, and no longer ashamed of it. At that moment the captain flew out of the room, and at once closed the door behind him. His face looked frenzied, his lips were trembling. He stood before the two lads and flung up his arms.
I don't want a good boy, I don't want another boy,
he muttered in a wild whisper, clenching his teeth.
If I forget thee, Jerusalem, may my tongue...
He broke off with a sob and sank on his knees before the wooden bench. Pressing his fists against his head, he began sobbing with absurd, whimpering cries, doing his utmost that his cries should not be heard in the room. Kolya ran out into the street.
Goodbye, Karamazov.
Will you come yourself?
He cried sharply and angrily to Alyosha. I will certainly come in the evening.
What was that he said about Jerusalem? What did he mean by that?
It's from the Bible. If I forget thee, Jerusalem, that is, if I forget all that is most precious to me, if I let anything take its place, then may...
I understand, that's enough. Mind you come. Ici, par exemple.
He cried with positive ferocity to the dog, and with rapid strides he went home. Part 4, Book 11, Ivan. Chapter 1, At Grushenka's. Alyosha went towards the cathedral square to the widow Morozov's house to see Grushenka, who had sent Fenya to him early in the morning with an urgent message begging him to come. Questioning Fenya, Alyosha learned that her mistress had been particularly distressed since the previous day. During the 2 months that had passed since Mitya's arrest, Alyosha had called frequently at the widow Morozov's house, both from his own inclination and to take messages for Mitya. 3 days after Mitya's arrest, Grushenka was taken very ill and was ill for nearly 5 weeks. For 1 whole week she was unconscious. She was very much changed, thinner, and a little sallow, though she had for the past fortnight been well enough to go out. But to Alyosha her face was even more attractive than before, and he liked to meet her eyes when he went into her. A look of firmness and intelligent purpose had developed in her face. There were signs of spiritual transformation in her, and a steadfast, fine, and humble determination that nothing could shake could be discerned in her. There was a small vertical line between her brows which gave her charming face a look of concentrated thought, almost austere at the first glance. There was scarcely a trace of her former frivolity. It seemed strange to Alyosha, too, that in spite of the calamity that had overtaken the poor girl, betrothed to a man who had been arrested for a terrible crime, almost at the instant of their betrothal, in spite of her illness and the almost inevitable sentence hanging over Mitya, Grushenka had not yet lost her youthful cheerfulness. There was a soft light in the once proud eyes, though at times they gleamed with the old vindictive fire, when she was visited by one disturbing thought stronger than ever in her heart. The object of that uneasiness was the same as ever, Katerina Ivanovna, of whom Grushenka had even raved when she lay in delirium. Alyosha knew that she was fearfully jealous of her. Yet Katerina Ivanovna had not once visited Mitya in his prison, though she might have done it whenever she liked. All this made a difficult problem for Alyosha, for he was the only person to whom Grushenka opened her heart, and from whom she was continually asking advice. Sometimes he was unable to say anything. Full of anxiety, he entered her lodging. She was at home. She'd returned from seeing Mitya half an hour before, and from the rapid movement with which she leapt up from her chair to meet him, he saw that she'd been expecting him with great impatience. A pack of cards dealt for a game of fools lay on the table. A bed had been made up on the leather sofa on the other side, and Maximov lay, half-reclining, on it. He wore a dressing gown and a cotton nightcap, and was evidently ill and weak, though he was smiling blissfully. When the homeless old man returned with Grushenka from Mokroe 2 months before, he had simply stayed on and was still staying with her. He arrived with her in rain and sleet, sat down on the sofa, drenched and scared, and gazed mutely at her with a timid, appealing smile. Grushenka, who was in terrible grief and in the first stage of fever, almost forgot his existence in all she had to do the first hour after her arrival. Suddenly she chanced to look at him intently. He laughed, a pitiful, helpless little laugh. She called Fenya and told her to give him something to eat. All that day he sat in the same place, almost without stirring. When it got dark and the shutters were closed, Fenya asked her mistress, "Is the gentleman going to stay the night, mistress?" "Yes, make him a bed on the sofa," answered Grushenka. Questioning him more in detail, Grushenka learned from him that he had literally nowhere to go, and that "Mr. Kalkanov, my benefactor, told me straight that he wouldn't receive me again and gave me 5 roubles. "Well, God bless you, you'd better stay then," Grushenka decided in her grief. smiling compassionately at him. Her smile wrung the old man's heart, and his lips twitched with grateful tears. And so the destitute wanderer had stayed with her ever since. He did not leave the house even when she was ill. Fenya and her grandmother, the cook, did not turn him out, but went on serving him meals and making up his bed on the sofa. Grushenka had grown used to him, and coming back from seeing Mitya, whom she had begun to visit in prison before she was really well, she would sit down and begin talking to Mashimushka about trifling matters, to keep her from thinking of her sorrows. The old man turned out to be a good storyteller on occasions, so that at last he became necessary to her. Grushenka saw scarcely anyone else beside Alyosha, who did not come every day and never stayed long. Her old merchant lay seriously ill at this time, at his last gasp, as they said in the town, and he did in fact die a week after Mitya's trial. 3 weeks before his death, feeling the end approaching, he made his sons, their wives and children, come upstairs to him at last and bade them not leave him again. From that moment he gave strict orders to his servants not to admit Grushenka, and to tell her if she came, "The master wishes you long life and happiness, and tells you to forget him." But Grushenka sent almost every day to inquire after him. "You've come at last," she cried, flinging down the cards and joyfully greeting Alyosha, "and Maximushka's been scaring me that perhaps you wouldn't come. Oh, how I need you! Sit down to the table. What will you have? Coffee?" "Yes, please," said Alyosha, sitting down at the table. "I'm very hungry."
"That's right. Fenya, coffee," cried Grushenka. "It's been made a long time, ready for you. And bring some little pies, and mind they're hot. Do you know we've had a storm over those pies today? I took them to the prison for him. And would you believe it, he threw them back to me. He would not eat them. He flung one of them on the floor and stamped on it, so I said to him, 'I shall leave them with the warder. If you don't eat them before evening, it will be that your venomous spite is enough for you.' With that I went away. We quarrelled again, would you believe it? Whenever I go, we quarrel."
Grushenka said all this in one breath in her agitation. Maximov, feeling nervous, at once smiled and looked on the floor.
"What did you quarrel about this time?" asked Alyosha.
"I didn't expect it in the least. Only fancy, he's jealous of the Pole. 'Why are you keeping him?' he said. 'So you've begun keeping him.' He's jealous, jealous of me all the time, jealous eating and sleeping. He even took it into his head to be jealous of Kuzma last week."
"But he knew about the Pole before."
"Yes, but there it is. He's known about him from the very beginning, but today he suddenly got up and began scolding about him. I'm ashamed to repeat what he said. Silly fellow. Rakitin went in as I came out. Perhaps Rakitin is egging him on, what do you think?"
She added carelessly,
"He loves you, that's what it is. He loves you so much, and now he's particularly worried. I should think he might be with the trial tomorrow, and I went to him to say something about tomorrow, for I dread to think what's going to happen then. You say that he's worried, but how worried I am. And he talks about the Pole. He's too silly. He's not jealous of Mashimushka yet, anyway."
"My wife was dreadfully jealous over me, too," Maximov put in his word.
"Jealous of you?" Grushenka laughed in spite of herself. "Of whom could she have been jealous?"
"Of the servant girls."
"Hold your tongue, Mashimushka. I'm in no laughing mood now. I feel angry. Don't ogle the pies. I shan't give you any. They're not good for you, and I won't give you any vodka either. I have to look after him, too, just as though I kept an almshouse." She laughed.
"I don't deserve your kindness. I am a worthless creature," said Maximov with tears in his voice. "You would do better to spend your kindness on people of more use than me."
"Eh, everyone is of use, Mashimushka, and how can we tell who's of most use? If only that Pole didn't exist, Alyosha. He's taken it into his head to fall ill, too, today. I've been to see him also, and I shall send him some pies, too, on purpose. I hadn't sent him any, but Mitya accused me of it, so now I shall send some. Ah, here's Fenya with a letter. Yes, it's from the Poles, begging again."
Pan Mussyalovich had indeed sent an extremely long and characteristically eloquent letter, in which he begged her to lend him 3 rubles. In the letter was enclosed a receipt for the sum, with a promise to repay it within 3 months, signed by Pan Vrublevsky as well. Grushenka had received many such letters, accompanied by such receipts, from her former lover during the fortnight of her convalescence. But she knew that the 2 Poles had been to ask after her health during her illness. The first letter Grushenka got from them was a long one, written on large notepaper, and with a big family crest on the seal. It was so obscure and rhetorical that Grushenka put it down before she'd read half, unable to make head or tail of it. She could not attend to letters then. The first letter was followed next day by another, in which Pan Mussyalovich begged her for a loan of 2,000 rubles for a very short period. Grushenka left that letter too unanswered. A whole series of letters had followed, one every day, all as pompous and rhetorical. But the loan asked for, gradually diminishing, dropped to 100 rubles, then to 25, to 10, and finally Grushenka received a letter in which both the Poles begged her for only 1 ruble, and included a receipt signed by both. Then Grushenka suddenly felt sorry for them, and at dusk she went round herself to their lodgings. She found the 2 Poles in great poverty, almost destitution, without food or fuel, without cigarettes, in debt to their landlady. The 200 rubles they had carried off from Mitya at Mokroe had soon disappeared. But Grushenka was surprised at their meeting her with arrogant dignity and self-assertion, with the greatest punctilio and pompous speeches. Grushenka simply laughed and gave her former admirer 10 rubles. Then, laughing, she told Mitya of it, and he was not in the least jealous. But ever since, the Poles had attached themselves to Grushenka, and bombarded her daily with requests for money, and she'd always sent them small sums. And now, that day, Mitya had taken it into his head to be fearfully jealous.
"Like a fool, I went round to him just for a minute, on the way to see Mitya, for he's ill, too. My Pole," Grushenka began again with nervous haste. "I was laughing, telling Mitya about it. Fancy," I said, "my Pole had the happy thought to sing his old songs to me to the guitar. He thought I would be touched and marry him." Mitya leapt up, swearing. "So there I'll send them the pies. Fenya, is it that little girl they've sent? Here, give her 3 rubles, and pack 12 pies up in a paper and tell her to take them. And you, Alyosha, be sure to tell Mitya that I did send them the pies."
"I wouldn't tell him for anything," said Alyosha, smiling.
"Eh, you think he's unhappy about it? Why, he's jealous on purpose. He doesn't care,"
said Grushenka bitterly.
"On purpose?" queried Alyosha.
"I tell you, you're silly, Alyosha. You know nothing about it, with all your cleverness. I'm not offended that he's jealous of a girl like me. I would be offended if he were not jealous. I'm like that. I'm not offended at jealousy. I have a fierce heart, too. I can be jealous myself. Only what offends me is that he doesn't love me at all. I tell you he's jealous now on purpose. Am I blind? Don't I see? He began talking to me just now of that woman, of Katerina, saying she was this and that, how she'd ordered a doctor from Moscow for him to try and save him, how she'd ordered the best counsel, the most learned one, too. So he loves her, if he'll praise her to my face, more shame to him. He's treated me badly himself, so he attacked me to make out I'm in fault first, and throw it all on me. You were with your Pole before me, so I can't be blamed for Katerina. That's what it amounts to. He wants to throw the whole blame on me. He attacked me on purpose. On purpose, I tell you, but I'll—"
Grushenka could not finish saying what she would do. She hid her eyes in her handkerchief and sobbed violently.
"He doesn't love Katerina Ivanovna," said Alyosha firmly. "Well, whether he loves her or not, I'll soon find out for myself,"
said Grushenka with a menacing note in her voice, taking the handkerchief from her eyes. Her face was distorted. Alyosha saw sorrowfully that from being mild and serene, it had become sullen and spiteful.
"Enough of this foolishness," she said suddenly. "It's not for that I sent for you, Alyosha, darling. Tomorrow, what will happen tomorrow? That's what worries me. And it's only me it worries. I look at everyone. No one is thinking of it. No one cares about it. Are you thinking about it, even? Tomorrow he'll be tried, you know. Tell me, how will he be tried? You know it's the value.